I'm Dr. Rod Berger. Sit back, grab a cup of coffee, and explore some of today's most pressing educational issues through the experienced eyes of leading education personalities. Welcome to Coffeed. Well, Mark, it's really nice to spend some time with you. There are a number of things I want to talk with you about, but there's one that just literally crossed my desk in the last couple of days, and I wanted to get your perspective on it, especially with your expertise in public-private partnerships and obviously the book that you've written and has now been acknowledged by the IPPI Awards as a Silver Award winner. I had a conversation with an organization that will remain anonymous for our discussion here today, but it's more about the role of PPPs in education, because it's a group that has meetings all over the country and summits, as they call them, around PPPs. And they had reached out to me, and I wanted to inquire with them about just the discussion with regards to education. And they said to me that that was not a part of, they hadn't thought about education in the context of public-private partnerships. Should that be as surprising to me as it was?
Probably not. I think that only a fool would try to build a business on public-private partnerships in education. Because it's a hard road to hoe. It is really just something that's considered by many in public education still to be the third rail. More specifically, and we explore this in our book, it's one has to really make the distinction between products and instruction, so to speak, I think to really understand that. The school systems in America have always used the private sector for products and for some services in the last, say, 20 years, services that are non-instructional. But the third rail is when somebody is really coming in and providing instructional services. That's when people get really excited, and not in a real good way in the public school systems. They really resort to the argument that that is their job and they should be doing it, and no one else should be allowed to do it. They don't want the competition. They don't want to really admit that they need help with certain populations of kids, and that's the slowest thing to change.
Yeah, I mean, I was really taken aback by it, that there was just this lack of even awareness. At least that's the way it was conveyed to me. And I know that we had chatted off air about the article that came out, Money, Race, and Success, How Your School District Compares, in the New York Times. And I've heard some other people make some comments around this as well, that, you know, this whole notion that we're still doing research regarding, you know, poverty and outcomes for kids. And I just can't help but thinking, when we're talking about the, you know, the third rail and these pieces that you're commenting on, that, you know, it seems like we're completely missing the target.
Oh, absolutely. The you know, soaking up oxygen, worrying about the tax structure of who's instructing the children is really not a very smart thing to do, given the level of difficulty that these kids are having. And this is really fresh on my mind, Rod. I just came back from Chicago last night, where I met with the school district there. We have a significant partnership with the district and with the communities on the south side of Chicago to recapture kids who have dropped out and bring them back in and educate them and get them to graduate. And one of our contacts at the school system was telling us that we really have to do a better job of telling the teachers union that we're not a charter school. Why that's my job and not the school district's job, I don't know, but apparently it's my job to do that. And the reason is that if it's a charter, the teachers union will try to kill it. It doesn't matter who it's helping or who the kids are, or whether it's kids that they don't want to serve. It's just on the principle of the matter. But if we're not a charter school, which we're not, we're a contract school with the district, then the teachers union is just fine with that. So again, it sounds preposterous, but this is still the focal point of where we are, not the fact that, you know, roughly 60,000 students are missing in Chicago public schools and have dropped out in the last few years, and nobody knows where they are. We're all fighting over who has the right to serve them.
It's as if the status quo is just what we're comfortable with. It's it doesn't matter what side we're on. It's just that we want to keep things the same. And if we're going to lose kids through the cracks, then we're going to lose them. And yet we don't want to think about it as a business, but yet these sort of challenges sound very business-like.
Well, they are. And the school system looks at it as if they're a business. They just don't like competition. And it's very frustrating because the children are in dire need of assistance. And again, it's not like we're out trying to get what they would consider the cream of the crop. We're really trying to help kids who have been abandoned by the school system or who have abandoned the school system. And there's still that undercurrent of resistance sometimes, which is just tragic, really, and sad.
You know, Mark, I want to sort of go back into the report or the piece in the New York Times where they, what's interesting about it is it's really an interactive piece where you can actually put in your district and sort of see where it lands relative to other districts around the country or how far behind the district is. But given your background and your expertise, I'd like to know, what do you look at when you're looking at scatter plots like this or when you're looking at data relative to education? Are there certain points that you look at, almost as if a coach looks at a box score after a game and says, these are the statistics that really interest me. They tell the story. What tells a story for you?
That's a great question. Certainly poverty and underachievement go hand in hand. That's not a mystery. But we really don't have to get economic data to know where our services are needed the most. It's just pretty obvious. For the most part, large urban areas, like Chicago or New York or Washington, D.C. or even Nashville, Tennessee, where I'm sitting, have large populations of kids that are underachieving for a variety of reasons. And I'm not one to blame the school systems. I think that they can do better. We can all do better. But honestly, what we have is such a huge problem in the community with the expectations for our children being so low, coupled with, I think, the sort of self-defeating dynamic where we have pushed school reform on our public school systems to the point, or with an underlying message that anything short of going to college is failure. And to me, that's the most destructive dynamic that's really hurting poor minority children right now, particularly in large urban areas.
It's not realistic to have that approach. Do you agree?
It's not realistic, and it's not helpful. And it's as if we're saying we would rather give you food stamps and keep you poor than for you to take a job that we think is beneath you somehow. And that is just really tough for me to get my mind around. If you teach a child a trade, it doesn't mean that child has to make a living off of that trade for the rest of their life, but they'll always have something that they know how to do. And it also discounts, this idea discounts the very therapeutic and beneficial aspects of work, what that means for a human being and how that builds your self-confidence and builds your self-worth. This is a frustration that I do sense is growing across the country, and one I sure hope we're going to do something about. We're really trying to put together some pieces at Chance Life to address this, particularly with our overage, undercredit students, who really just are not set up. They're not ready right now to go to college. We can get them through high school, but they have to be able to feed their family. Many of them have children. They have bills to pay, they have families to support. And I was meeting with a large group of folks this last week, many of whom are folks who were very engaged in negotiating, between different street gangs and how to keep violence down in what has become a horribly violent part of Chicago. And listening to them talk about what these children need, what it takes to get them off the street, what it takes to get them to quit selling drugs, doesn't take as much as people might think. I think there's sort of this conventional wisdom that the kids can make so much money selling dope that they wouldn't want to work. That's just patently false. Kids don't make much money selling dope because it's very risky. People rob them regularly. They have to pay somebody else most of the money. And at the end of the day, they might end up with $50 in their pocket for the week. And if you put them in a position where they're not scared and they're working and they're occupied and they can make at least that much, the consensus on the street, anyway, the people that I'm talking to, is that that would be make a tremendous difference in these kids' lives and really cut way back on the criminal activity and therefore cut way back on the killings and the shootings and all the mayhem that's going on in Chicago every day. And I think that same thing could be said of Philadelphia or Washington, D.C. or New York City or Los Angeles or a variety of places.
Yeah, the stories that people don't really want to hear about, because that's what keeps people up at night, is when you really know, when you're in the weeds of it, you see the disparity between, you know, what is put out in popular media and what is actually going on the ground can be very, very different. Mark, I'm hesitant to ask you this, but given where we are in the calendar, I would be very curious to know how should, whether it's just a mom or a dad, you know, a community member, how should they be looking at the election with regards to education and what might be coming down the pike? Because sadly, we're not seeing any discussion around education.
No, we're not. I think the reality, Rod, is that the pendulum has swung and is swinging rapidly away from federal influence on our public education and right back to the states where it was 10 years ago or more. And so I would tell parents that they need to be focused on what's going on at the state level, what's going on in their state legislatures, what's going on primarily in their local school systems, because the federal government is really sort of washing its hands right now of a lot of things that they were pretty heavy-handed about over the last two administrations. And over the course of those nearly 20 years, a lot of things were taken away from local school districts and certainly from states in terms of their control, and that's all rushing right back into their control and their influence. And so that's where the decisions are going to be made, and that's where the solutions are going to be found. That's what I would say. And I don't think it matters a whit, frankly, between the two kind of front runners in the presidential race as to what's going to happen in education. I think neither of them are focusing on it. It's just not the hot issue it was 10 or 15 years ago right now. And I think they both would rely more on the states to do it, and they're focused on other things.
Yeah, that actually is what scares me even the most, is that we're not talking about it in the national news, because you just wonder what's going to happen, what are the impacts going to be on, you know, the private sector, those nonprofits, just providers, and also innovators too. That's the other thing, Mark, that strikes me, is that we're missing out on so many innovations and just ideas from people who say, well, I don't want to be involved in education because of the bureaucracy. I mean, to your point in the beginning about really, you know, who would start a company, we're talking about the PPPs, right, and engage in education.
Well, you know, I guess I'm a contrarian, Rod, and always optimistic. I guess I believe the glass is always full, just nobody promised you what was in the glass, I guess. But I think that there's always more opportunity for the entrepreneur with local control and sort of disaggregated regulation. When things get really regulated in a central way, like from the federal government, then public-private partnerships become commodities, and innovation gets stifled just because it's so regulated and so controlled that it's almost becomes pointless sometimes to have the private sector involved. If the private sector is not going to be allowed to do what it can do better than the public sector, which is fail faster, make changes quicker, deploy capital faster. If it's not going to be allowed to do those things, and really there's no point. It's just not worth the political harangue that you're going to go through to try to do it. On the other hand, when local school districts are told, look, it's your problem, go fix it, or states say, look, we've got a Tennessee-specific problem or an Illinois-specific problem, and that gives entrepreneurs and private operators much more opportunity, I believe, to really make a difference and get in there with creative solutions. It's just a lot easier to sell an idea, to work on a solution that's creative with a public school district than it is to start at the federal government and try to convince somebody there that fits in with their idea of what everybody ought to be doing.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, it will forever be a complex situation working in education and trying to match, state and federal interest.
I do think, just to add one more thing, don't mean to interrupt you, but on education entrepreneurship, I think the overwhelming push on test scores and measurables has pushed the education entrepreneurs into almost this exclusive mode of ed tech, where everything's about gamification and technology. And I think that we're entering a new phase where it's going to be much more about practical solutions and the possibility that innovation doesn't really always have to be about technology. It could be about your approach. It could even be about how you form relationships with students. There are a lot of ways to innovate that I think have been somewhat overwhelmed and stifled by our rush to adopt technologies in schools.
Yeah, no, it reminds me of the best-selling author Daniel Pink, A Whole New Mind, a book a few years ago. Just to, the more complex we get, we basically sort of fold back into ourselves. To your point about getting so tech-centric that at some point we're going to have to look at some practical solutions, because if we don't know how to integrate these pieces in for different populations of students and teachers, it really doesn't do anything at the end of the day other than provide a pretty, good marketing slick that goes out the community that says we're doing something fun and exciting and potentially engaging for the kids.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, Mark, this has been really great. Obviously, there's so many different avenues to continue to go down, and one of them that I'd like to follow up with you on the next time we chat is, you mentioned the accountability piece in there towards the end, and the irony that I find is that, obviously schools and the system wants to have accountability with regards to outcomes for students, with students in schools, but yet the accountability from those that are providing the structures in education sometimes is not exactly as stringent as it is with the students that occupy the schools.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Thanks, Mark.
All right. Thanks, Rod.
Join us for our next cup of coffee as we continue to have conversations in education that matter to you. I'm Dr. Rod Berger, and this is Coffee.